The mules are in the corral. Welcome to Mule Talk, and I'm Cindy K. Roberts, your host.
And our author, TV personality, and world-renowned mule trainer, Meredith Hodges of the Lucky Three Ranch. Today, we're going to talk about differences among horses, mules, and donkeys. So nobody knows it better than you, Meredith, so go ahead.
All right. Well, I have spent 50 years with mares, mules, and donkeys. And I've done a lot of observation, you know, just watching them in the field and everything, which adds to all of the clinical information that I've learned and training information. And one of the main things, you know, there's a lot of things that are thrown out there that mules are tougher than horses. They don't require as much feed. So that those are kind of the obvious differences. But even those things aren't really that different, because you got to realize that the mule foals are raised by their mothers, horses. So a lot of the things that they pick up are very similar to horses. But when you're talking generally, when you're just generally speaking, people are talking about the things that are the most obvious. But I made it my business to see if mules were able to compete in equine and horse events, and I spent a lot of years, 20 years doing that and competing my mules against horses in all these events. And in doing so, I realized that the differences weren't that stark, that they were really subtle differences and they depended on a lot of other things.
Okay.
Now, mules are definitely exceptional, and they're exceptional because they will inherit the mare's beauty. They used to use culled mares, and so those mares weren't very good looking. And then, of course, the jacks weren't watched very carefully either. So what you would come up with is a mule that could do his job, and he had these exceptional abilities, but he wasn't very pretty. And so, But, you know, and then a lot of the things that people were saying was, oh, horses are just prettier animals, and I'd rather ride a horse than an ugly mule. But that kind of discounts them pretty quickly. The mule, because of the contributions of the jack, the strength and the athletic ability of the mare combined, the mule ends up being an exceptional hybrid because he inherits the best qualities from the dam, and he also inherits the best qualities from his sire, the jack. And the jack is responsible for his muscle structure and the thickness of the bone and the strength and the intelligence. And so this makes the mule an exceptional equine. And what you will see in this exceptional equine is how agile and how athletic he is because of the smooth muscle in his body. Horses have bulk muscle throughout their body. But what happens with bulk muscle is the same thing that happens with a weightlifter. They can lift and carry heavy things, but when it comes to agility, they're not very agile and they're not very flexible. But the mule, because of this long muscle throughout his whole body, really is. And that's what's noticeable when you put a horse next to a mule, is how smooth his body is compared to the horse's body that is more lumpy with bulk muscle. The other thing that you will notice if you're watching, you know, mares and foals with their mule babies out there and their horse babies, you will see that when they take off and they're prancing around, these mule foals raise their heads, invert their necks, and prance right under their torso. A mule or a horse baby will arch his neck and prance. And this, you know, this is, you know, pretty handy to know when you're finally riding these guys, because it's easier to stop a horse with a one rein stop than it is a mule.
Right.
Because the mule actually will brace against you because he raises his head so high, mm-hmm. because he inverts it, puts his nose in the air, and just lets you pull on the bit. He doesn't even clamp down on the bit, because I doubt that they can really do it effectively in that position. And so they just let that thing ride on their lips, and their lips are like rubber, and so you can't get them stopped. And if you try to turn them with a one-rein stop, you can't really do that either because they're so strong in their neck and in that position that they don't give.
Right.
But a horse will.
Mm-hmm.
And a horse spends his entire life that way. With the arc neck. So the really apparent things that you see too with this bark boat muscle is seen very clearly in the chest of the mule. The horse's chest has two muscle groups in the front, which create a very distinctive line of separation in the middle of the chest. But the mule's chest is more like a turkey breast, and it doesn't have a definitive line. You can kind of see a little bit of an indentation, but not very much. But that also gives him a lot of flexibility in the front end. And so he can, you know, do cutting horse moves. He can, you know, he can go up, he can go down, he can go underneath himself, and the mobility of the front quarters is amazing. And in the hindquarters, it's the same thing. Now, the mule and the donkey both have steeper shoulders and steeper hips than a horse does. Horse generally has a 45-degree angle in both of those places. So his movement is a little bit more restrictive because it's not quite as independent. And so the mule in the hindquarters, he's got long, wide, smooth muscles that enable him to kick every friggin' direction. He can even lift his hind leg up and scratch his ears if he wants to do it. A lot of people have argued with me and said, oh yeah, my horse can cow kick, but a cow kick is a whole lot different than being totally flexible in the hindquarters and have this amazing range of motion back there. They are capable. This is why what makes them so good in the mountains is because they, you know, when you've got rocks and things and logs and stuff to climb over, mules are quite capable of climbing under, over, and through most kinds of fencing, terrain,
right,
whatever it is. You know, they can,
yeah,
they can kind of wiggle their way through just about anything. This is why they get out all the time. You know, they figure out a way to do it, and then they've got that strength and intelligence from the jack in there that just makes it, you know, something that they will peruse, and they usually come up with solutions really quickly. Donkeys, on the other hand, they have to think about things a little bit longer. So sometimes, you know, a mule can come up with a way to get out quicker than a donkey will. But once the donkey figures it out, he can definitely do it just like the mule, because that's where the mule gets his intelligence from. And so let's get on to strenuous use of those muscles. Because the mule and the donkey are more long-muscled, those muscles don't get tired as quickly.
Okay.
They tend to get strong, and they are sustained. They're more like the core elements that are supporting the skeleton. And so this is why it's really important to develop those core muscles in the skeleton, because they will combine with the long muscles as far as tractability, flexibility, agility. All of those things are things that a ballet dancer needs to have. When you get those long muscles strong, they're a lot stronger than the bulk muscle that people are just trying to build up. You hear about people doing training programs, and endurance riders will see how many miles they can ride. Cutting horses and reiners develop that bulk muscle. But if that core muscle at the bottom is not developed first, then you don't have the long muscle flexibility underneath those bulk muscles, and the animals that are developed with bulk muscle may be able to travel farther for a while. They might be able to be strong in certain positions, but not all positions that the body can do. And so they do get kind of restricted. And because they're restricted like this, their circulation is affected. the way that the joints are affected, and they are susceptible to arthritis. And because of the circulation, they may develop allergies, or what looks like allergies, because the skin doesn't have adequate circulation, not just to the skin, but to the muscles underneath and everything, and it's not free-flowing. This is probably why they say that mules are tougher. They have unbelievable vigor and strength, and it's passed on by the donkey because it is more free-flowing in the circulation because of this long muscle. They have good circulation to the hooves, and therefore their hooves are tougher. They're more resistant to parasites and disease. They're more sure-footed because more than not, they are able to move these different elements of their body a lot more freely than a bulk muscle equine. Given all of this, you know, it's kind of evident why the mules are stronger, tougher, more resistant to parasites and disease. But it's also important because they are thinking animals. The horses are, oh good, you're going to pet me, you're going to feed me, that's nice. But they're not really all that enthused about being with you. Not as much as a mule is.
Right.
Yeah. Mules think people are the greatest things when things are going well, and they love playing games with us, and they love learning new things, and they're fully engaged. And so, you know, this is really good, and they love to go exploring, and so they love to go riding in the mountains and do all the things you want to do. And they really enjoy all of the activity at the shows as well. And they are as competitive as we are, and they can be as engaged as long as we don't interfere with their intelligence. Their intelligence includes keeping themselves safe. And in doing so, since you're with them and generally on them, then you will be safe too if you listen to them. But the old adage, stubborn as a mule, came from people who decided that the mule didn't know what he was doing, and when he locked up, instead of listening to them, decided to fight with them and try to force them to do something they deemed as not so safe. So you can get into a really, really unsatisfying situation with these guys pretty easily. Now, right now I'm reading a book by Bernie Harbers, which is one of these guys that has ridden mules across the country. There's another guy called the Mule Man, and he's done the same thing. And in watching these videos and reading these books, this evidence of running into the stubborn mule comes up quite a bit. They don't think, in Bernie's book, for instance, there's a place where he came to a bridge that was nothing but iron mesh. And in crossing the water, you could look down and see the stream running down below. Mm. Well, his mule, Cracker, wasn't having any part of this.
Sure.
And he tried. And of course, you know, from trailer loading, you know that if you keep a taut rope, that they will eventually give to it and walk across it. But this was a situation that it was get across this bridge or they weren't going any further. And even Bernie acknowledged that there was a crossing underneath the bridge across the creek. Now, he had two mules. He had the Cracker, the one he was riding, and he had Brick, the one that he was packing. And it took him a long time, even with help from a guy in a truck and everything, to get Cracker across this bridge. And so Bernie thought, well, what if I hide Cracker around the corner at the other end of the bridge, then Brick will want to catch up with him and she'll go across the bridge. Wrong.
Uh-oh.
Brick, being a female, wasn't going to give in at all to that force. So Bernie finally decided that he would take Brick down to the creek and let her go across, which she did very willingly. But that's a case where it absolutely shows you, clear as a bell, the Cracker was trying to tell Bernie that it wasn't safe to go over that bridge. And then Bernie recognized that with Brick. So he learned his lesson from the two mules and the way they did it. But this is the way our mules are with us. So as I always say, when I find out what the solution that's coming from the mule is, it's generally just common sense. So common sense should be applied when you're trying to understand a donkey or a mule's behavior. And it holds true in any potentially dangerous situation, because we as humans know what we want to do, and we don't always think about safety and common sense when we're deciding what we're going to do. So if your mule is trying to tell you that something is not what he wants to do, you probably should listen to him and try to find an alternate route. They have incredible innate intelligence, and like I said, humans aren't always concerned with what's best for them. But the mules and donkeys do. They should be listened to. So when a male donkey with his traits of superior intelligence, strength, and muscle structure is bred to a female horse with a calm disposition, good conformation, athletic ability, the result is an exceptional and incredibly beautiful animal that we call the mule.
You bet.
That's the obvious stuff. Now, there are other things that are different between mules and donkeys, and I have listed them in columns under horse, mule, donkey. The horse has an incredibly reactive flight reflex.
Yes.
Mules will kind of think first and react later, and will most often divert themselves to the flight reflex, although they have been known to freeze and think about things. And when they do, then they employ the donkey reflex, which is the freeze reflex. So in Bernie's bridge incidents, obviously Cracker was employing the freeze reflex first. Then came the flight reflex backwards, because he didn't want to go over the bridge, so he just started backing up. And a lot of times that's what they'll do. I have learned, too, that when I'm doing the coordination stage of the training on the lead rope, that they use these reflexes quite evidently, and the most evident obstacle is the bridge. And a lot of people do what I was doing in the beginning and putting these reflexes, or not these reflexes, but the obstacles in the arena, which left a lot of room around all these obstacles, and left room for them to employ every resistant behavior that you can possibly imagine.
Yeah,
wow. So when they're out in the open, you know, what happens when you're going up to a bridge and they don't want to go over it? You get dragged around the arena. And there's that raising the head thing that they do at foals.
Right.
If they come to the bridge, then they use backing up. If you can get them close to the bridge, and let's just say you have a fanny pack full of oats, let's say maybe you don't have oats. Maybe you don't have oats and they know that this treat that you're going to give them is just a little thing, and it's not ongoing, and it's not something that they really prefer. They're going to make the effort proportionate to the reward. So they love oats. You can get them to do just about anything with oats, but not so with the other rewards that they try to sell you.
Right.
And even sandwiches, peppermints, even the little horse treats that they make and all that stuff, it just does not motivate them the way you think it's going to motivate them. And so they don't like it when you get really forceful about things. But if you set up the situation where it's the only way to go, then you get a lot less resistant. I decided that the best thing for me to do was, in my 60 by 180 foot indoor arena, I set up my round pen at one end, a 45 foot in diameter round pen, and then I put my obstacles around behind it in a horseshoe shape. I had gates on both sides, so they had to go through a gate. First thing, they had to go through a gate. The last thing, they had to go through a gate. But when they got through the gate, then we closed the gate. And right in front of them was the bridge with a fence on both sides. So that kind of gave them motivation. Oh, there's only one way around this. If I turn around, I'm running into a gate and a fence. I got a fence on three sides, but she's walking over this bridge. And so, and I had a 12-foot lead on them so I could get all the way to the other side of the bridge if I wanted to and just stand there and hold the lead rope taut, which I have learned that they give to. So I just stand over there, and then I just open the fanny pack and start playing with the oats. And I tell them, well, if you want your reward, here it is, and it's oats. And boy, you'd be surprised at how fast I can get them over those bridges. You know, they learn to get over that bridge really fast. And later I will come back and have them square up on it in all different positions and everything once they've gotten through it. I put my big tractor tire on the other side where the other gate and the other fences on both sides would be. And I put the easy obstacles around where the places were wider. And where it was really wide, again, at the one far end, I put a row of ground rails next to a row of six tires. Mm. And when we got to that point, I said, okay, take your pick. You either go over the rails or you go over the tires. But eventually, you're going to have to go over both of them. That's the way we handled obstacles for a long time in the introductions and the second stage obstacles, where I actually square them up in different positions through and over these obstacles. And that got them through there, and it was building their core strength without the runaways. When I was having the runaways out in the open, they were evading that bridge every which way they could.
Sure.
And I was noticing, that their movement was extremely unbalanced, and they were not doing anything for core strength at all. And so when they would stop, they were stopping, and they weren't stopping four square, and it didn't matter when I got done with it, if I'd set them up four square at the end of the whole thing, didn't really matter, because the next obstacle they were out there undoing everything that I did. And this is why I decided to minimize that bad reaction to things. And then I found out after I did those enclosed obstacles, now they're not afraid of them. They still didn't see much sense in going over something and through something that they could just go around.
Right.
Now, that's what they try to do in the beginning with you. And they're very adamant about teaching you a lesson about how uncommon sense this is to go over and through these things. This is just another dumb thing that humans do that,
right.
You know, I don't really want to do it. But after you do the enclosed things, then they go, okay, well, you know, she's really insistent about doing this, so maybe I ought to not fight so hard and just do it. And so your fights are not as bad. They'll pull a little bit, you know, but if you stand there with the taut lead rope, they won't make you go running backwards. You know, they won't drag you around the arena to avoid it or anything. They get to be a little bit more submissive with that. So, you know, you got to understand that this flight reflex can be really, really awful when it's coupled with intelligence and long muscle. Boat muscle, a little easier to hold. You can pull them around and all that like you can a horse, but not so much with the mule.
Right.
Horses have fragile health. Mules and donkeys are more resistant to parasites and disease. But I do think that all has a lot to do with how fussy they are. They are fussy about what they eat and how much of it they're going to eat. And so when you give them this mixture of rolled oats and shobo and corn oil, you're giving them the best things that they really like to eat. But not only that, Manipro was a one-a-day kind of vitamin that doesn't overload their metabolism one way or the other. It just makes them feel healthy. But horses will eat just about anything that goes in front of them. So when you feed them all of these high-end, lush feeds and stuff, they'll eat it, and then they don't feel that good. And then they're more apt to have problems with parasites and contagious diseases. This is also true of the conditions that they live in, too. Horses can be very awkward on uneven ground, as we saw in that post where that horse ran slamming and right into that raised ground and then lost his balance all the way through. Mules and donkeys, generally speaking, will not do that. One thing I want to say, too, about the feeding thing is that a lot of these feeds make for hooves that are not really that hard, and they start to collapse with the weight of the animal. And you see it most often in the hindquarters. You know, I've even seen mules where they're collapsing sideways on their hooves, and they're losing heel because a lot of these mules are trimmed by farriers that aren't familiar with the upright hoof of the mule and donkey.
Right.
And this has turned into a really big problem. I've seen so many of them where those hind feet are collapsed and the feet are kind of soft. Even if they're black, they're soft. Conversely, I've seen light-colored hooves be quite, you know, Sir Lancelot has light hooves, but they're hard as a rock. And I have a good farrier that knows how to trim them properly for mule feet. You know, this too is really helpful when you're talking about riding on hard surfaces. 9 times out of 10, a mule does not need to be shod. And that brings up the issue of these boots that people are using. They say, these people are giving the excuse that the boots can be taken off, and so they aren't as hard on the animal's feet as shoes are, which restrict them and keep their feet from flexing and breathing, as they call it. They're not supposed to breathe.
Right.
Their hooves are supposed to be, you know, stable and hard, and that frog needs to have contact with the ground.
Yep.
And so you know, this is another thing that was real, very enlightening about what Bernie was saying, because I really didn't know what to tell people about these boots because they've become very popular. And I used the boots when Roll had white line disease and we had to resect 2/3 of his hoof. But see, I used both the shoe that my corrective shoer had shaped for the 1/3 that was left of his foot. And we put that on. And when Rock was sinking through and had navicular in the front, we couldn't put shoes on the front because he'd had so many nail holes in there from wearing shoes all the time that we really couldn't. We could put them behind, but we couldn't put them up in the front. So we used boots while we were trying to heal that navicular and get a better angle on the bone and all of that. And in that case, it worked pretty well because Rock wasn't moving around. But people are using these boots for trail rides. And in Bernie's case, he's riding all day long in these boots. And what he discovered was that Cracker was getting shoe boils in there.
Oh.
And his heels were getting really sore. Because the boots don't fit like shoes do. Like
right.
You said, they're like, these people are telling me they're flexible. They move around a little bit and allow for expansion, which you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
So just go ahead and, you know, even though the boots are better, you know, when you're riding on concrete and asphalt, my experience was with my animals, we were doing a lot of parades and stuff, short-term riding, but I thought, you know, those boots are still rather slippery on asphalt. Asphalt is really slick. Cement, a little less slick. So what I would do, if I knew I was going to be riding in a parade, I would just shoe my animal all the way around with borium beads on the shoes to give them traction.
Right.
And that also keeps them in good posture. When they're sliding around on those boots, if they misstep and it slips, it's just as easy as you spraining your ankle because you stepped the wrong way.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't take very much to do that. So I'm not one that condones boots for riding. I really do not think they're a good idea.
Yeah.
I think they're okay for Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me, and what I've been doing works for me, so.
Well, me too. And you know, I've always kind of taken into consideration what events I'm going to do. So if I was going to do reining in an arena, first of all, I'd like to see those arenas built right.
Right.
And have nice flat sliding ground underneath the sand they put on top.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise you can get hooked in ruts and stuff. But I think slider plates on the back end are a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And having good shoes on the front, it's a good idea.
Sure.
If you're going to go trail riding and everything, 9 times out of 10, I don't put any shoes on at all. Because their feet are quite competent for normal trail riding.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to, you know, go for a few hours, that's fine.
Yeah.
If you're going on a pack trip, you'd better put shoes all the way around because they will wear their feet, but then go ahead and put those borium beads on there to give them some traction going up and down hills and in the rocks and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, mules typically are more sure-footed all the way around, as are donkeys, than a horse is. Their feet are not as delicate. They're not on an angle where they can manipulate them that well. Actually, those up and down shoulders actually put them so they can kind of tippy-toe through all these things, which I think makes them more sure-footed. Horses have more platter-type feet. If you've got platter-type feet, you tend to be a little less particular with your feet, and you can trip and fall a lot easier. The oval, narrow, more upright hoof structure of the donkey and mule actually makes for more sure-footedness. Horses typically have a longer slope to the shoulders and the hips, which is fine for reining and cutting and a lot of the things that they do, but the steeper shoulders and hips on the mules and donkeys make for more deliberate hoof placement. And when you have a longer slope to the shoulders and the hips, and you don't have that deliberate foot placement, your stamina is compromised because you go quicker through things and with less deliberate hoof placement, and that takes energy. So it eats into your, you know, the stamina of your animal. That's why mules are really good for endurance, because they're incredible energy preservers. They don't waste energy where it doesn't need to be wasted.
Right.
Right?
Oh, I love that about them.
Yeah, and donkeys certainly, I mean, they're energy conservers all the way to the bank.
Sure.
You know, the mule, he'll waste a little bit of energy because he's got all that horse energy in there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there you go. And the horse goes, you know, kind of barging through things with this flight reflex, this unrestricted flight reflex, but will come back to you pretty easy. But mules, when they resist us, are trying to conserve their energy. They're trying to preserve their stamina. And he gets easier to manage as his core strength is addressed and strengthened, and the postural end of things is straightened. And the good thing is he likes those leading exercises, which is the only way you can get core strength, because they're easy. They're real easy. They're non-confrontational, and you won't run into all this stuff unless you try to do obstacles in the open. You know, then, right. then you're gonna do what I said, and you're gonna undo everything you did.
That's
but the
right.
leading exercises are something you can do really easily, and it's very deliberate, and it allows him time to chew and not get anxious about what we're gonna do next. And the big thing about this is, the mules and donkeys never forget what they learn. And this is most evident when you leave them on pasture all winter at the end of the riding season, and then you come back in the spring. Every time you come back in the spring, the horse thinks he has to buck. It doesn't matter what he's learned. You get on him, and he's got to buck. The first few times that you get on. Every spring, it seems not to ever fail. But the mules and donkeys don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
When you get on, they go, oh, I remember what we do, and they don't do that. They just don't. Horses, therefore, are more reactive than intelligent about things. Donkeys and mules are more intelligent about their things, what they do and what they don't do. And then the important thing that you will learn in the hourglass pattern, leading them, you know, on this arc, trying to develop this core strength and this postural balance and have them do a lot of self-carriage, is you learn to communicate with them. And you do it with your verbal commands. You do it with your body language. And you do it with the five senses you were talking about. You have the hearing, the eyes, the smell of everything. Now, what I do that's a little trick is that I learn from my animals, this was really funny too, that they not only spook at obstacles, but they spook at smells.
Oh, yeah.
And when I came out there with my newly bathed self in my Shalimar, they thought I was a weirdo. And they would bolt and run from me.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought, well, I've got to do something about this. This has something to do with the way I smell. I just bet you it does. And so every time I go out there, when I was filling my fanny pack, I would not wash my hands. I would just go ahead and fill my fanny pack and wash my hands in the oats. And I would spill them all over myself. And so then I got a completely different reaction from that, from them. They would come up to me and they would be sniffing me, which was their smell thing. And they would be very intent and interested, and their eyes would brighten up, and they went looking for these oats all over me. and then, of course, then I thought, you know, this is kind of cool, but what else is there? You know, that you got their ears and their hearing and everything. I wonder if the verbal commands, if the way that I talk to them doesn't change things too, because all these other senses are very keen on these animals.
Yes.
And I know that when they're looking across the field and they're very intent, I know they see something, but is it, I thought, is it as much seeing it as it is hearing it? And so more often than not, they would be hearing something and something would come over the horizon. And it would be maybe another horse or maybe a dog or maybe a person or whatever. So their hearing is very keen.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I noticed is they all have different voices.
Ah.
Now the horse, you know, he's kind of, he does his neigh on an exhale.
Right.
So it's hee hee hee. And if you do that, that's more of a, hey, 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 go away, you know, and or, hey, 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 there you are.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a very wide variety of a vocabulary.
Mm.
But, and the donkey bray is like, it's an inhale and an exhale. It's like, here I am. you know, and then here I am, I'm going to talk to you kind of thing. And the mules are half go away nay and half come to me bray. But in both the mule and the donkey, there are a wide variation of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me wonder if I would have more success with them if I did what most people call baby talking. But it's not baby talking. I realized what I was actually doing was not baby talking these guys, but I was listening to their voices and talking to them the way they sound to me.
Really?
So, yeah. So, okay. Like, for instance, Lance's neigh bray is more like a... And so when I call Lance out of the field, I go, Lance! And he comes to me immediately.
Oh, how funny.
And Lindy, for instance, has a neigh bray that is kind of a... So I call her Lindy Lou. And she comes right away. And then Vinny always goes, he always looks like, wah. And he'll do, and I go, Vinny. And he comes. And I do that with every one of them. Their neighs and their neigh bray is different with every single one of them, but I try to match their tone when I'm talking to them. And that, I have found, engages them so much better than just going, walk, trot, whoa, back, you know, which is kind of a monotone and very uninteresting.
Right, right.
But when you learn their language, and that's part of it, the verbal communication that you do with them becomes very important. And so, you know, a lot of people, for instance, I do kicking training. This is another thing, because they do like to kick. And when I'm training them right off the bat and during the grooming sessions, that's when you're going to see if they're going to be a kicker or not.
Yeah.
And so I go ahead and use a driving whip, and I run it all over their bodies, and some of them will stomp mm-hmm. with the front feet.
Yeah.
And if they do that, then I just whack them right on the fetlock joints with a very quick, here I am. Mm-hmm. It's not abusive. It's just, here I am, and I can reach that, and don't do that again. And mm-hmm. then I say, no.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I say, no. And with the back feet, and it's only one time for each stomp, or one time for each kick from behind. And accompanied with this loud, no, loud and firm, no. Because I'm setting it up, that is going to be the punishment word. You know, as they get down the road and they don't kick very much anymore, say I'm in there grooming 12 of them, and I'm walking right down between the two lines of six, and I got all their butts at me, my mules will raise a hind foot. It's not that I've stopped them from kicking, but I have set it up so that my verbal voice is going to be the warning signal.
Mm.
So if they raise a hind foot, I say their name, and I say, no, and I say, put that down. And if they don't put it down, I walk right up to them in good posture. I walk to the side that they're picking up, and I grab their tail, and I pull their weight right onto that foot.
Yeah.
So they don't even know that it's coming. And they can't kick because the foot is now on the ground. It's not in the air anymore. So they really got to think about it if they're going to raise the foot again or raise the other foot or swing around or do anything. It's kind of shocking to them. But that way, I can do no from a distance and correct any behavior I want with a no. That's it. Don't have to go too far with that. You know, when you're doing this training, you need to kind of think like that. You know, consider they are intelligent animals. Don't try to do the forceful behaviors that you can get away with a horse. The horse, obvious difference, has 64 chromosomes. The mule, generally speaking, has 63, although some Molly mules have been known to have 64 mm-hmm. and have been able to conceive to Jackson stallions. And they're good candidates for embryo transplant, too.
Okay.
And then the donkey has the donkey has 62. I have a friend down in Colombia who does embryo transplant on their farms. It's pretty interesting, all the different things that they've got down there. You know, they've got donkey mamas that are producing hennies, too, and they're testing all this stuff. So I get a lot of information from them, you know, from practical experience in the field, which is really good. Horses' sense of self-preservation is not strong at all. Horses will throw themselves into a tizzy trying to resist something and actually put themselves in greater danger.
Right.
They jump into, you know, barbed wire fences. They throw themselves over backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Mules, donkeys, not so much. They, if they're doing something, they have a very strong sense of self-preservation. And they won't do things to hurt themselves. And in a moment of freeze brain, one of those kind of moments,
right.
brain freeze thing, they may end up in the middle of a fence, but they know that they're supposed to, they should not keep struggling. They should stop and look at you with a very embarrassed face and go, will you get me out of this, please?
Right.
And there again, you're getting communication, whether it's body language, whether it's verbal communication. He's going, yeah. This is when touch becomes very important as a sense. When you're imprinting foals, lots of people think that imprinting foals, you imprint them when they're born and then it's done. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. That's just the introduction to touch between you and your equine, your mule, your horse, whatever. And so when you're touching them, you need to make yourself aware of what your touch does in the specific areas of their body. Now, a lot of people will walk up to a horse or a mule and you go, they don't know anything about them, and you go, oh, go ahead, you can pet him. And they go, bam, 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 right on his nose.
Right.
Well, you know, that is very impolite to do. In realization and observation about which way the hair is going, and in observation about the way the mare strokes the baby on the face, you will learn that she goes with the hair, and she also does it right below the eye, which is a very soothing place. So take note of this, and when you want to calm your animal down, your equine down, it's very good to touch them, but you need to know how to touch them and where to touch how. It's really important. When you're going between the ears and over the pole, you want to have a lighter touch and not move anything, not move the ears sideways or backward or anything. Don't be invasive about it. When you're going under the jaw, over the jaw, you can put a little bit more pressure. You go under the jaw, you can actually put a lot of pressure because that's an itchy area right under there, you know. And they like it when you scratch under the jaw right between the bones. That's really cool.
Yeah.
But then when you get, say, to the end of the nose where the whiskers are, those whiskers are very sensitive. And they keep the animal from putting his face in the wrong place or bearing too much pressure down, because otherwise it would tear that tissue, that very delicate tissue that's around the nose. So that's why I encourage people, do not clip those things for show. They may look a little sloppy, but they do the animal a good purpose. And if he's in a stall in a strange place, for instance, and he's running his nose along the wall of the stall where he's being kept, that's what's going to keep him from snagging his nose on a nail or something,
uh-huh.
maybe sticking out just
yeah.
a little bit. So, you know, for safety's sake, they have all these things for a reason. And when you're stroking him down there, you just come down the nose along with the grain of the hair and with the grain of those hairs that stick off, because they have a direction too, and it's mm-hmm. down. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you're stroking them, if you stroke those hairs up, they're going to pull their head back and it's going to hurt. When you go along their mane, they love it when you actually grip their mane and pull the hair up. They can take a lot of really heavy touch that way. But then if you take that same heavy touch down the neck, you got to lighten up, man, because the skin is thicker down there as you get off the crest, and that can hurt them. Under the throat, it can hurt them. Mm. Going over the shoulder bones, that is another place to lighten touch, you know, but and down the legs. You don't want it too light. It has to be, down the legs has to be a contact touch that is firm, but non-invasive and not in a way that would hurt them in any way, shape, or form. Across the back, my God, if you go over the spine, a donkey will go ahead and sink his back if it's too much touch there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the flanks. Yeah, in the flanks, that's another area, you know. But they seem to like it okay, you know, where there's muscle. You can get pretty heavy with the muscle and heavy with the massage where there's muscle. And you should have core underneath that, because if you don't, you're going across fatty tissue, and you might be getting into a very weak core that's very, you know, sensitive underneath. So imprinting goes on with okay. all the things that you're exposing them to.
What about static electricity?
I try to ground myself on that.
I have sparked my mule a couple of times, and then she wouldn't come near me for 2 or 3 days. And
right. I have a can of static guard in the grooming grooming stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. I use that and I spray myself with it. If the static electricity is really high, I do not spray it on them.
Okay.
I will spray it on the blankets.
Okay.
I will spray it on the fleece pads. Leather, you usually don't have to worry about. But it's you that's usually the conductor of the electricity.
Okay, right.
So I just keep that. I haven't had a problem with it since I do that. But I do have a problem when I forget to spray myself and I shock them.
Yeah.
But then they just sit back and they just look at me like, why'd you do that? You know?
Yeah.
My guys, you know, I have been so, you know, I've been so careful with all of these senses that I'm getting, including the extrasensory perception that they have. I know that they can tell what kind of mood I'm in, too. So if I'm in a really bad mood, I just won't go out and work with them, because I know they're going to nail me for it, whether I try to hold it in or not. They'll know I'm faking it. Then they'll get all suspicious about it. Then they'll snort at me,
right,
and let me know that they know, you
yeah.
know. And this is just them talking, you know. Now, a horse does not talk to you that way. You know, mules and donkeys will. Donkeys are a little bit more sedate about it. They're a little more subtle. And then, you know, then they get mad, and then they do things that are subtle. Like with a donkey, if you're touching him too hard, for instance, he'll just move his foot over and stand on yours.
Right.
You know? Now, the mule's a little quicker about it, but that is one way he will get you. That's why you should always wear boots. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I must say, in all of this training that I've done, I've never gotten a broken bone from my animals, because I'm very, very careful, and I don't want to get hurt, and I haven't wanted to get hurt from the beginning.
Right.
So I'm very cautious about what I'm doing. I abide by the rule that the animal is always right, because, and that goes for any animal, because their reactions to things are 100% instinctual, and they're 100% honest. So anytime that they have any kind of disobedience at all, it's generally of loss of balance that I have caused. And so I have to rethink what I'm doing. And the disobediences that they do are only you know, things that they're doing to give me an indication that maybe you want to rethink this. You know, it's just a suggestion from them. You know? So you can't really get mad at them for
right,
it.
Right.
You know, and if I'm not listening very well, you know, it's really funny how they do this, because when I'm not listening very well, and when I'm standing there grooming one of them, for instance, and I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing, and maybe I hit a spot over a bone a little too hard or something like that, a lot of times they'll just take that front foot and step on my toe. If I'm really blowing it, they step on my whole instep, and they crush my metatarsals. I've had, even with boots on, those are the bones that have been broken, but I can fix those with a little bit of chiropractics and tape.
There you
and let them heal, and then stick them back. I can stick them back in the boots after the swelling's gone, you know. And then I am a whole lot more attentive the next time. And when I have I figured that if I'm grooming, then I better pay attention to what I'm doing and not have a cell phone around. Actually, I don't even have my cell phone anymore. It's pretty useless with me. My landline works just fine.
Yeah.
And I don't need those kinds of distractions. But I do need to realize that I need to be fully engaged with my animals. That's
right.
And everything that I think has to be about them when I'm with them. And even when I'm developing my ranch and doing such things as setting up cross fencing and all of that, I do it with them in mind. I do it, how can I do this without a halter? So I can move all these animals, because I had 32 animals at one point, and they were in different groups and had to go to different turnout pens.
Mm.
But I didn't want to have to halter everybody.
Sure.
So I set the things up, and we've got the barns on one side of our hay road, and then we have turnout pens on the other side of the hay road. So we just put in a mule crossing from barns, you know, over to the other turnout pens. And then we have turnout pens that go out back. And we've got two barns, one with 10 stalls, one with 14. And sometimes they have to go through one barn to get turnout pens, or through the other barn to get to the other side. And so, and the other thing was, is that we had to be consistent about the groups we put together, the way we handle those groups, how we run those groups across the road through the mule crossing thing and into the turnout pens, and so that they would know where they're going without using halters or anything. And when they're coming back, they need to know, are they in the north barn or are they in the south barn? Well, since we keep the north barn mules together and the south barn mules together, then we know, everybody in the south barn knows that when they're on the north side and have to go through the north barn, that they have to keep going to get to the south barn. And then when they get in the south barn, they all get into the alleyway and stand right by their stall doors and wait for us to open them. And it's when you're consistent like that, you know, you think, oh, well, I'm just teaching them this or teaching them that. But actually, you're enhancing the communication between you. And you're opening up your vocabulary, and you're expanding your communication skills with them. And when you do that and everything that you do becomes predictable, the anxiety level in your animals goes down substantially. Where most of the time they have high anxiety because they don't know what you're going to do next, even in training or even in this situation of turnout, even in grooming, it goes across the board. And pretty soon, what you have is animals that are willing to approach anything you want them to approach and do anything that you want to do if you just stop and have a conversation with them. You know, you can stand there and they can balk on something and you can say, well, no, I know when this was built. So, and I know how much weight it can take, and it can take your weight. Don't worry about that, because I thought about you. you know, and they go, oh, okay, you thought about me? Oh, well, maybe you're not so stupid after all. Yeah, and they'll come along and go with you. The mini donkeys. When we were building the Jasper bunkhouse, we had to put drywall on the inside of this mobile home. And so Steve was in there ripping off all the walls, the plastic walls, and refurbishing it with drywall. And he was had plaster in there, buckets of plaster, buckets of paint, all these different tools he was using and everything. And so I took Spuds and Augie, the mini donkeys, because I thought, well, this is a good thing for them to learn. And so there's a porch right out in front, and I knew the porch would hold them. It wouldn't hold the big mules, and I knew that.
Right.
So I decided to take both mini donkeys, and they balked right there at the steps. I just sat down on the steps and had the conversation. Look, you guys, you've gone over a bridge. This is just like the bridge, you know? And they go, oh, it is? And I said, yes, it is. And then I gave them oaths for acknowledging me, that I was talking to them and that they were responding. And then Augie always went first. And Spuds was, I don't trust you. And Augie'd go, oh, you can trust her. You know, and so Augie got up there on the porch first. And then came Spuds, and I gave them both oaths then. Then we had to go through the door to the inside in the middle of all that chaos that Steve had created. And so I pulled Augie into the doorway, and Augie goes, oh, what's going on here? And I said, that's right, Augie. That's the right attitude to have. This is more chaos. Don't you want to look at it? And he goes, oh, maybe I do, because if I do, I'll get more oats. And so I got him in there, and Spud got to the doorway, and he looked back and forth, and he's, oh, no, this does not look safe at all. And he goes, oh, it's okay, Spuds, it's safe. And he goes trotting across the living room with me, and Spud left in the doorway. I got the end of his lead rope, but I don't have the lead rope, and I got to make sure he doesn't swing sideways and knock over all the paint buckets and everything that are in there. I let go before I let him do that, you know, so, but I got them both in there, and then I just sat on the floor, and I just pointed around all the different things, and I told them what it was and everything, and then we just turned around and walked out the door, and that went really well, and then Augie went down the steps, and Spuds went, I can't do that. Spuds, you just went up these stairs. Can't you go down the stairs? You can jump down the stairs. It's only one step, Spuds. And Augie goes, yeah, it's only one step, Spuds.
Yeah.
And so those Spuds jumped down, and they got their oats, and then we walked away, and that was really cool, you know. But, you know, you could never do that with a horse. They would, or a pony. You know, in the case of Spuds and Augie, they were minis. If I tried to take a pony in there, that paint, the plaster, everything would have been all over the room if I could even have gotten them in.
Sure.
You know, horses would rather be grazing.
Right.
You know, and that's okay. That's okay. That's what they do. You know, so what you want to do is you don't want to ask them to do things that are really unnatural for them. And we've already done enough of that in the society. My God, they can't go roam on the prairie and eat when they want and exercise when they want and eat minerals when they want. You know, they're really restricted. So we have to introduce them to a way that they can be fulfilled. I still go out in the pasture and see saw my brood mares and their foals and everything, and interacted with them the way they wanted me to. I structured my land and the cross fencing so that everything was the way they wanted it to be. My donkeys could not go on pasture without getting obese in the first 5 minutes. So I went ahead and constructed a fairly wide area, this like 40 by 60, with pea gravel on the ground that they could go ahead and be in every day, no matter what the weather was like. And it would drain properly because it was pea gravel and no mud, you know, because, oh God, they're awful to groom when they get that sticky mud on them.
Oh, yeah.
But if it's pea gravel, they could get in the mud, but then in turnout, because the bigger turnout areas, I've got large dirt pen turnout areas, and they got many spots in them, but they can come into this pea gravel, and what they'll do is they'll roll around, and when they roll around, they take it off for you, so you don't have to scrape all that mud off of them. If you could just wait an extra day and let them do it, they'll do it for you. And this is how I kind of learned how to structure all of the situation in the way I laid out the property. The other thing that I found is when I let them out on the big hay fields in the beginning, they would poop all over the hay fields, and then when we harvested the hay, it would come in with poop in it, which accelerated the growth of mold in the hay.
Ooh.
So decided that wasn't such a good idea. So we have designated turnout areas that are rather large. Our largest turnout areas are like 5 acres. Those are where they can go, and we keep those harrowed. And we spray for weeds in there, too, and then keep them off it for a week or two before they get turned out on it, so there's no chemical issues
right
there.
Okay.
And I know that a lot of people like to keep their herds together and feed these big round bales.
Yeah.
But anytime you give an animal free choice like that, it's a risk for their health. There are some with personalities that they think they got to be there all day at the feeder. There are some that are much more active and play and kick up their heels and run around and get to the bale to eat. And everybody else has eaten most of it already, so they don't get as much feed. You can't really monitor their intake when you've got those things.
Right.
The other thing about big round bales is that there's so much hay, it's not something that you can feed unless you have a very, very large herd in one day. And the longer it sits there, the bigger the risk of it getting wet in the snow or wet in the rain and developing mold from the inside out. So, and that's what your animals get to eating as they get further into this big round bale. Then, of course, hello, veterinarian, you're going to have colics and maybe even the founder.
Yeah.
So buying these round bales, even if they're at less cost, really don't end up being less cost.
Mm-hmm.
I have found that good land and livestock management and attention to each animal. I do grooming as a group, all of them, once a week. I just put all my grooming tools in a bucket and go in there, you know, once a week and look them over head to tail and find any scratches, scrapes, cuts, anything. And I don't usually find very many because all of the training that I do and the interaction that I do the same way. I lead them the same way, whether I'm getting them from the pen and just going to groom them and taking them up to the tack barn to do it, or if I'm doing it in the field and I or wherever I end up leading them, I lead them the same way. I hold the lead rope in the left hand. I point in the direction of travel with the right hand. I keep their head at my shoulder, but I do not manipulate their bodies. I want self-carriage in good posture always. And the only way I'm going to get that is if I repeat the way I lead them, the same way, the same every time. If
right.
I get in sync with their front legs, mm-hmm. I don't get sloppy about that either. Whenever I am going to walk off, I say their name. I say, walk on. And I give them the heads up. That's what we're going to do. I don't want them walking circles around me trying to decide what way to go. I want them to learn to wait. And when they do, then I give them their oats and I wait for them to chew them all up before we go. So that teaches patience. There are so many things in that seemingly easy pattern that is the hourglass pattern that you don't have to do it a lot. It only needs to be done once around one direction, once around the other. It takes 15 minutes, and you only have to do it once a week.
Yeah.
But it's amazing all the things they learn
right.
from that one pattern. It's just thinking ahead and planning and interacting with them the same way all the time and picking up on the little things that they're teaching you along the way.
Very well said. Awesome.
Very cool, Meredith. Well, it's lunchtime.
It is. You have a great rest of the day, Cindy.
Meredith's website is lucky3ranch.com, and you can call her at 1-800-816-7566. And I can be reached through my website, everycowgirlsdream.com.
Gotta go. My mule is looking for me.
Mule Talk is an Every Cowgirl's Dream production.